everybody. This is John Rosania, and I'm here with Dr. Amy Myers on the Myers Way podcast. This is our third podcast, and we're going to be focusing today on a single issue, a very specific one, and it's all about the thyroid. And Amy is quite an expert in the thyroid department. So we're just going to start and kind of jump right in. So Amy, how are you doing over there?
I'm great. I'm in Denver, and it's beautiful.
Great, great. So Amy, I'm going to jump right in here around thyroid.
Okay.
I actually asked friends of mine in the wellness community and other people I know with thyroid issues to actually give me some questions as well, things that they have been kind of burning to get answered. So I have a few of those kind of for the end. Let's start sort of big picture here. And I want to just get a sense of how common are thyroid issues today?
I would say that it is probably, when we're referring to autoimmune diseases, thyroid is the number one autoimmune. Hashimoto's is what people are probably most familiar with, having heard that term. In terms of thyroid, in medical conditions, I don't know where it ranks, but it's certainly one that's very underdiagnosed. And I know we'll get into that as we go through the podcast about why that would be, that many conventional doctors are not really checking what I consider to be the appropriate test, but it's extremely common.
Okay, so then if today it's very common, let's just talk about, just so people have a good sense of that in the big picture, what are the most common thyroid issues today?
Low thyroid or hypothyroidism is probably the most common. And I don't know if you want me to go through symptoms of that or we'll get into that. There's something called low T3 syndrome, which we can also get into. And then of the people who are hypothyroid, Hashimoto's, or that autoimmune condition, is the most common. And then less rare is hyperthyroidism, where your thyroid is overactive. And that typically is an autoimmune condition, and that's called Graves' disease.
Okay, yeah, I was actually just looking at a quote from your friend, Chris Kresser, as well, and he says that notes that 1 in 8 women have Hashimoto's disease, as well as up to 10% of women over 60 have clinical or subclinical hypothyroidism.
It's a pretty staggering statistic, right? And I would imagine most of those people don't know it.
Yeah, that's incredible that undiagnosed and then untreated as well. Okay, great. Well then, so Amy, one of the major things that when I was asking sort of wellness community and people out there about this issue, one of the things they just wanted to know is if you could just give a little, sort of a little mini med school, and just giving a little bit about a sense of what is the thyroid and what does it do? And then how does one know they have a thyroid issue?
Sure. So I think of the thyroid as really one of your master glands. When you're thinking of a car and the motor, I mean, that is really what your thyroid is. It's your motor. It's your metabolism, so to speak, that if it's high, you're overactive, and if it's low, you're underactive. So the thyroid gland just sits right sort of in the middle of your neck, where if you know where your Adam's apple is, when you swallow, for some people it's kind of pronounced, you see a little ball that sticks out in your neck, and that's where your thyroid gland sits. The thyroid gland communicates with some other glands in our body through what's called a negative feedback system. And so there's your hypothalamus that's in your brain. And the access that I'm going to be referring to is the hypothalamic, I cannot speak today, pituitary thyroid axis. We just call it the HPT axis. And so what happens is when your thyroid is low, when you're not producing enough thyroid hormone, a signal goes to your brain, to your hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus then sends out a signal, which is called the thyroid releasing hormone. And that's abbreviated TRH. And TRH goes down to your pituitary, which is also in your brain, and tells the pituitary then to release what is called a thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. And that's really one of the blood tests. We can check that. And that's the main blood test that most doctors check for to assess whether someone is hyperthyroid, what we call euthyroid, which is normal, or low thyroid, hypothyroid. TSH then so the pituitary releases the TSH and it goes to your thyroid and tells your thyroid to start producing more thyroid hormone. And the majority of that thyroid hormone that gets produced is called T4. And then an itty little bit of T3 gets produced.
And Amy, is that just referred to thyroid 4, thyroid 3?
Yes.
Okay.
And so a large amount of T4 gets produced, and then from that, a little tiny bit gets converted into T3. And then from there, T3 can get converted into what's called free T3 or reverse T3. And that free T3 is actually the most active form of the thyroid hormone. And it's able to go into all of our receptors and keep us warm and keep our hair from falling out and keep us from gaining weight and giving us energy and keeping us from having brain fog. And we'll get into this, but that's one of the tests that most doctors don't test for. Anyway, so we have T3 or reverse T3. And reverse T3, actually, people tend to convert more from let me just back up. There's T4. It gets converted into either free T3 or reverse T3. And I think of free T3. So the thyroid is, again, producing T4 that then a little bit gets converted into T3. And that can go to free T3 or reverse T3. I think of free T3 as the gas and reverse T3 as the brake. And so free T3, again, as I just mentioned, keeps us warm and gives us energy and prevents brain fog and from gaining weight. Reverse T3, we don't really know what it does, but I do see it elevated in people who are very stressed, starvation, and people who have high heavy metals like mercury. So when you have enough thyroid hormone, that then sends a signal back up to both the pituitary and the hypothalamus and tells them, okay, you can stop producing the thyroid releasing hormone and the TSH. So just to recap that, we have two little endocrine glands in our brain, the hypothalamus and the pituitary. When thyroid is low, the hypothalamus tells the pituitary, the hypothalamus releases TRH, thyroid releasing hormone, and tells the pituitary to release TSH. The TSH then goes and tells the thyroid to release T4 and T3. And then the body then makes free T4, free T3, reverse T3.
Okay. So before, when you were explaining a little bit about the major or the common thyroid issues today, so we have a kind of a sense there of some of the ways in which these hormones are functioning in the body. So then what can you just give a little bit? You said a little bit while you were giving that description, but can you say a little bit more about the symptoms, common symptoms for the two or three major types of thyroid issues?
Yeah, so we'll take the most common, which is low thyroid, hypothyroidism. And, you don't have to have all of these symptoms, and you don't have to have them to the degree in which I'm going to state them. Fatigue is one, brain fog, being cold, having cold hands and feet, hair falling out, constipation, weight gain. So everything in the body is really kind of slowing down. So, and again, you don't have to have those all or to the degree. And also, let me mention low temperature. So that's probably one of the number one things. I mean, many people that come to see me are generally coming in. I mean, there are very few people that are coming to see me for no matter what their main problem that they're coming for. But fatigue is usually one of the symptoms that people commonly are complaining of when they're in my office. And so I would say fatigue, weight gain, and then low temperature. I check everyone's temperature when they come to see us. It's considered a vital sign, but it's the one that I probably pay attention more to than even a blood pressure in my office, because thyroid is so underdiagnosed. Even with somebody having completely normal labs, if they have several of these symptoms that I've just mentioned, plus a low temperature. So really, when I'm getting people particularly in the 96 or even 97 range, I mean, that is below normal. And I take that into account with their symptoms. And then hyperthyroidism is sort of the opposite. It's an overactive thyroid gland. And this is, again, much, much less common. But that is where everything is overactive. So you may feel warm or hot when other people don't. You could be losing weight, anxiety, fast heart rate, of course, at an exaggerated point, you could have an elevated temperature. I mean, there's something that you could even go into. It's called thyroid storm, where things are so exaggerated that you could actually die from it. Your heart rate is so high. Your temperature is so high. Everything is on overdrive with that. So, and again, that's much less common. That is what I had. I had Graves' disease. And so my symptoms with that were weight loss. And I was hungry all the time and eating a lot. I had weight loss and anxiety were probably the two biggest that I had. It can also, when it got to the point that mine did with an autoimmune disease, I was even having muscle breakdown. I mean, your whole system is on such overdrive, you're just burning through everything. So I was even having to the place where, you know, I had lost so much weight and fat that I was actually beginning to break down my muscles. So when I would go down the stairs or something, my legs would tremble. And then I even had a tremor. That's how overactive my system was. When I went to reach for something, I would have a tremor. Most people don't get, most people get hopefully picked up before they get to that point. I was in the middle of medical school and was initially thinking it was stress. And then as the symptoms continued to get more exaggerated, I realized that, something was really going on with me.
When you were talking about how important it is for you to measure temperature, was your temperature elevated as well?
That wasn't something I was aware of, and my doctor never mentioned that to me. So I never checked my temperature during any of this. Now, after if you all can listen to podcast number one to really hear my story surrounding this and what I ultimately ended up doing. I mean, I tried all kinds of natural remedies, Chinese medicine, reached out to holistic practitioners, and I ultimately took some medicine to suppress my thyroid gland and got something called toxic hepatitis, where my liver was breaking down and I could have died from it. So I ultimately ended up having my thyroid ablated with some radiation. And so I don't have a thyroid. And so I pretty quickly over the next weeks to certainly months became hypothyroid and had to start taking the medication for my thyroid. And at that point, I was very aware of checking my temperature. And I, of course, was reading all of this stuff even back in medical school. My thought process was more open-minded. And so I would read books about this. And I was fortunate that my endocrinologist, the person managing my thyroid at the time, was open-minded. I don't think overly open-minded to his other patients, but because I was a med student, I was coming in requesting things. I was checking those things and I was requesting extra what we call T3.
Okay, so Amy, what are the tests you recommend for thyroid and what are the tests that doctors are not doing?
So with testing, and one of the reasons that I believe thyroid, at least the underactive hypothyroidism is so underdiagnosed, as well as Hashimoto's, the actual autoimmune aspect of thyroid disease is so underdiagnosed, is that most doctors and even specialist endocrinologists, so the specialist that would manage this condition would be an endocrinologist. They're managing your endocrine system, and of course your thyroid is part of that endocrine system. And so most of them as well, the vast majority are not checking all of the labs that someone in functional medicine like myself checks. So when someone comes in for just a regular visit with me, no matter what their complaint is, because of this vast underdiagnosis of thyroid disease, I check a full panel on everybody and what I consider to be a full panel. And I just want to mention here, I did write a blog about this, so you guys can hop over to my website at dramymyers.com. And the point of the blog was really so that you could print this out and take it with you to your doctor. It talks all about the lab test I recommend, the reference ranges, and kind of what to do about it. So feel free to print that out and take that with you to your doctor. But the lab tests that I check are, of course, the screening marker, the TSH. So free T4. I, of course, check a free T3. I check a reverse T3. And then I check thyroid antibodies, a TPO, and then a thyroid globulin antibody on everybody. And just for the sake of assuming people don't know what an autoimmune disease is, that's really, and I also recently wrote a post on my blog about that as well, about what is an autoimmune disease and what can you do. But really, it's that your body has turned on itself and it perceives itself as being foreign or some aspect of itself. So in this case, it would be your thyroid. So it's that your body, our immune system there is to protect us from viruses and bacteria and invaders of any sort. And what happens is, it's a complex issue, but just to quickly boil it down, is that your body begins to attack itself or attack a gland like the thyroid gland, perceiving that it is foreign. And it causes inflammation. And then ultimately, over time, the thyroid gland can begin to die off. And that's how it results in a hypo or underactive thyroid. So I check those antibodies on everybody. I have definitely picked up on people where they have antibodies to their thyroid, but their thyroid is still functioning optimally. So it really hasn't gotten to the place where it's destroyed enough of the gland to where they need to be on medicine. But what that tells me as a physician, most regular physicians have no idea what to do with that. They wait until it destroys enough of the gland, then they give you medicine. What it tells me is that clearly there's a problem with the immune system. And what does that mean? Well, that means leaky gut. That means a gluten sensitivity, in my opinion, possibly an issue with grains and legumes because of the lectins. And so we really go in and begin to look at the gut and the diet and go through the Myers way and all that stuff that we've kind of talked about in previous podcasts. And I'm sure we'll get into more in future podcasts. But so I actually do intervene with people who already have antibodies to their thyroid, even if they don't need thyroid medicine. So again, just to recap, what I consider to be, you know, a panel would be a free T4, free T3, TSH, reverse T3, and then thyroid antibodies. So the fact that most doctors are not checking anything but a TSH, and if you're lucky, maybe a free T4, but the vast, vast, vast majority of them out there are not checking a free T3, certainly are not checking a reverse T3, and very few are checking antibodies. So a large number of the tests are not even being run. So that's one reason that people are being underdiagnosed, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that even the Academy of Endocrinology believes that the reference range for thyroid, particularly a TSH, is way too broad. And so what a reference range is, when you're looking at your labs, it's those numbers on the side that, you know, between, you know, 0.1 and, you know, 4.5 for a TSH are normal. Well, what we in the, you know, functional medicine community believe is that optimal is, of course, very different than normal. And optimal for a TSH is between 1 and 2. And now if you're on thyroid medicine like myself and I actually take free T3, which we'll talk about in a moment, that can artificially suppress your TSH. So some practitioners, I do check a TSH just for the sake of it, but a lot of practitioners that practice like I do, maybe don't even check a TSH because it's kind of meaningless. Really what we guide ourselves with is the free T4 and the free T3. And of course, the patient's symptoms and listening to the patient. And then I use temperature as well. So again, doctors are not checking the right labs or a full panel. And then doctors are going for normal rather than necessarily optimal. So somebody may come into a doctor's office and say, you know, I have gained, you know, just slowly over the last year, 10 pounds. I have, you know, really been watching what I eat. I've, you know, been exercising. And I mean, it's just not budging. And I'm really cold and my hair is falling out and I'm feeling really depressed. And maybe they're, you know, 43 years old. And the doctor's thinking, well, maybe they're kind of perimenopausal, or maybe they're even, you know, 46, 47 and getting maybe starting to have irregular periods and thinking, oh, cool, they're probably just getting ready to go through menopause. You know, you're older, of course, your metabolism isn't going to work as well. So here, let me just give you an antidepressant, you know, or let me put you on the birth control pill to regulate your hormones. So they're really, and maybe they just checked a TSH on you and it comes back and it's, you know, 3.2. Well, that's totally within normal range. But again, they only checked one part, so we don't know in that scenario what your free T4, or certainly what your free T3 is doing. And then they might not have checked a temperature or really listening to the patient. But a patient like that, of course, that doesn't necessarily come into my office in the sense that I obviously check far more labs, but certainly people come into my office with those labs saying, I went to my doctor, I've been everywhere, I'm struggling with this, and you know, I tried the antidepressants, they're not working, I don't want to go on the birth control pill. You know, something's up here. And they'll come in with that. And I'll say, well, you know, I'm listening to you. You have some of the symptoms. You know, depression can be one. You've gained some weight and you just can't get it off with everything that you're trying. You're cold. And look, I noticed on your vital signs here that your temperature is 97.2. and you know your TSH is 3.2. Well, let's repeat that along with all the other labs. But I'm suspecting that there's actually going to end up being a thyroid problem here, and you know, we may need to go on medicine. Now, I'm not a physician that, you know, just throws medicine at people, as you all know. I mean, unless it's Diflucan, an antifungal to treat the candida in your gut, there are very few medicines that I'm giving people. We really want to get to the root cause of what's going on. And we can talk about that in a few minutes as well, kind of what are the thoughts of why we're having so much thyroid disease as compared to, you know, in the past. But thyroid is one of the ones that I do give medicine for because people do feel better. Now, I, of course, work at the root cause as well, fixing the gut, getting them off the inflammatory foods. Sometimes, you know, that will do it. And if you're kind of borderline, we wait. We go through that whole process, go through the Myers way, fix the gut, optimize your nutrition, add in some iodine, give you the cofactors that you need for your thyroid to run, selenium, iodine, and iron and B vitamins, and we give you all those things to see if it's an issue with not having what you need for your thyroid to properly run, as well as getting you off the glutens and the other inflammatory foods that could be a problem. And if that turns it around, great. Some people are so far gone that they do need a little bit of medicine, and they feel great when they have it.
So, Amy, around this testing, I had a question for you about, for people who are not experiencing, let's say, the most obvious symptoms, would you say if anyone's sort of going in and working with a functional medicine doctor, it's just something they want to do a test for thyroid issues just across the board, regardless, just to get a sense of where they're at, even if they're not experiencing symptoms?
Absolutely. I mean, I have a panel of about, I don't know, maybe it's 25 blood tests, and that's not including the functional labs. That's just what we consider traditional labs, what I can get through the regular lab. I have about a panel of about 25 tests that I order on everybody that walks in the door. Now, children, it's a little bit different. You know, rare for a child to have a thyroid issue. Certainly, if I have had parents bringing in children because they're overweight and they can't seem to lose weight, and if they're coming in with a specific complaint that would really direct me towards the thyroid, I'm not going to overlook that in a child. But it is far less common. But if you're coming into my office from, you know, teenage up to whatever, in your 90s, I'm checking thyroid on everybody because, it, you know, that list of symptoms that I gave you, I mean, depression to, you know, anywhere from depression to anxiety, from fatigue to feeling hyper, constipation to diarrhea. I mean, the spectrum is so broad, hair falling out, cold, brain fog, it could be so many different things, and thyroid is certainly one of the things that it could be. So I feel like it is, I mean, most doctors do a TSH screening, at least for women on their annual exam. Women do tend to be more affected by the thyroid, and we can get into that as well of why that is. So a TSH is even on a regular doctor's screen, and yes, if you were going to someone who's an integrative practitioner or functional medicine practitioner, my guess is that on their general screen, your first time going to see them, that they are going to have that full panel that I mentioned. I don't know about the antibodies. Maybe some people are more selective about that. But if you're coming to see me, that panel's getting run on you, absolutely,
okay,
regardless of your symptoms.
All right, cool. Okay, so, and it was interesting too here also to hear, Amy, that, you know, from teenagers on. So it's quite young people as well that can be tested for this. I know your experience, I think, with these issues was in your early 30s.
Mine was in my early 30s. And the reason that I do teenagers, and again, that's just in my office. I don't know, you know, with, again, the average, if you're just going for an annual checkup, teenage maybe doesn't need to be screened. But if you're coming to me, something's going on. And so that you've gotten to me rather than a conventional doctor. So I do include that in with my teenagers. And I have seen, absolutely, I have several women that are, you know, in college that are on thyroid medicine and had thyroid issues.
Okay, cool. Okay, so let's go a little deeper. You touched on it a little bit. Let's go a little deeper into causes, and then what are some of the things we can do about this? So you spoke specifically about autoimmunity and wheat. So could you go a little bit more in this connection? You know, you focus a lot on wheat and gluten. So could you go a little more into this connection now about gluten's relationship to these conditions?
Sure. So, well, there's two thoughts. I mean, one is that there is a thought that the new wheat, and the reason that I call it the new wheat is because we've hybridized the wheat that our parents or our grandparents used to eat, and in that there is more gluten, and we don't our body has not seen that before. When we hybridize the wheat, the rather than when we genetically modify something, genes replace other genes. In this case, genes merged with genes, and there are more genes in the wheat and leading to more gluten in the wheat. There are some thoughts that this new wheat actually can look like the thyroid, the molecular makeup of the thyroid. And so for some people, the thought is that it's what's called molecular mimicry, that they're looking the same, that the body's trying to go attack the wheat, but the thyroid looks like the wheat, and so it starts attacking the thyroid. That certainly may be plausible and part of the picture. The premise that I work off of is the leaky gut premise, and I don't want to blame only wheat. It's certainly part of the picture, but in my theory, there's never one thing, and part of it is that we live in a toxic world. We are taking more medications than ever, ones that decrease our stomach acid, ones that, help us with inflammation and pain, and that affects our gut lining, to ones that are antibiotics and kill off our good bacteria. And all of that disrupts our gut and our gut lining and barrier. Then we have all these toxins, and then you add in either genetically modified foods and now this hybridized wheat, and suddenly 80% of our immune system is in our gut, and suddenly we have disrupted our gut through all of these mechanisms: the medications, the disruption of the gut flora and fauna, the heavy metals and chemicals coming in, and then these genetically modified and hybridized foods, and the tight junctions in our gut break apart. And we then have what is called a leaky gut. And then larger food particles can slip through, and they begin to stimulate our immune system. And that is, boom, we end up with an autoimmune disease. These larger particles, like wheat, can then get through. They're very, very inflammatory. They were not meant to get into our system. We, have these, I mean, our gut is somewhat permeable to allow smaller parts of food to get through. But once those tight junctions are there to really act as our, what are those, like a moat, back in the day with the castles, and it had the moat, and the moat was there to protect people, open when somebody good was coming, and then it would close when somebody bad was coming. It's kind of like that. It opens enough for these smaller particles so we can get our nutrients, and then they close, they're kind of slightly opening and closing all the time. But when you break them and the moat, bridge, or door no longer works, then anything can come in. And that's kind of what is happening with a leaky gut. And then these larger molecules that our body was never meant to see in our bloodstream turn on our immune system.
And so even though that's happening in the gut, then once the immune system is sort of turned on, if those, let's say, particles of gluten and all are similar, or they look like sort of the thyroid, so then the immune response goes out throughout the body and will start hitting the thyroid.
Right. I mean, so that's the whole point of the whole idea. Our heart is pumping blood around every minute of every second of every day. And these inflammatory markers and our immune system, our little cytokines and stuff, are getting pumped around and going around and creating systemic inflammation. I mean, that's the whole idea, as we talked about in the first podcast, that in medicine, we're taught these different parts of our body, and nobody ever brings it together of here's your whole body and how does it interact. And it's extremely important because it is. So that's why a lot of people with autoimmune diseases, even though the destruction may be going on only in one particular gland, it's settled in, it's like, okay, it's the thyroid that we're going to attack. You can actually see markers that we use for systemic inflammation all around the body. And those, again, are markers that I check on everybody that comes in the door. Things like an ESR or a CRP. These are markers, and you can check an ANA. I mean, there are a lot of different markers you can check, but I check things like a CRP, which is a which is a, the cardiologists use that marker for cardiac inflammation and look for risk factors for cardiovascular events like a heart attack. I use it as very non-specific, but it gives me an idea of if there's inflammation going on in the whole body for that person. And that's one of the screening markers that I do. So yes, it opens up to systemic inflammation. And for many, it stops there and it's just joint pain, or it's a swollen, you know, part of the body, or it's fatigue. And for someone else, that systemic inflammation goes beyond and actually gets to the place where your body has started to attack itself. And then that, yeah, go ahead.
Amy, do you almost always see elevated CRP levels when people have thyroid issues?
Not general thyroid issues like a hypothyroidism, but I mean, I can't give a statistic. You would think that if somebody had an autoimmune disease, their CRP would automatically be elevated, but it's much more complicated than that. They do not always go hand in hand, but no, I do not see a CRP elevated in people who have thyroid conditions necessarily. Do I see them in people who have autoimmune conditions? Yes, I do. But nothing is exclusive of one another. If you don't have an elevated CRP, it doesn't mean you don't have inflammation. It doesn't mean you don't have an autoimmune. But it's just part of the picture and part of the screening process.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you certainly can have a very elevated CRP and not have an autoimmune condition. But most people with elevated CRPs, I mean, a CRP could be elevated with any inflammatory condition. You could have broken your leg and your CRP is going to be elevated. You could have stubbed your toe on the way to get your labs drawn and your CRP. You could have a respiratory infection or be recovering from the flu. You could have cancer. So again, I mentioned in the first, or I don't know which podcast it was, talking about, you know, becoming a patient is listening to the patient, you know, listening to what's going on to be able to put those pieces together, because the patient is really going to help guide me in all of this.
Amy, do you see a relationship as well, or a higher relationship of people who are celiac to autoimmune and specifically thyroid conditions?
Yes, there is a very large correlation, but there's also a large correlation of people who have, if you have one autoimmune disease, you're far more likely to get a second. Your immune system has already been turned on. The circuitry of the computer, so to speak, has already, you know, been altered. And so you're far more likely. And now the link between celiac and either autoimmune thyroid or celiac and you know, thyroid in general, there's a very strong link there. And again, my belief in what I have read and what I know goes back to the gluten and the link between gluten.
So, Amy, in talking about some of the ways to kind of deal with this, you talked about the importance of dealing with leaky gut. And leaky gut, we addressed pretty deeply when we were going through the Myers Way on podcast number 2 and checking in on issues like gluten, grains, legumes, beans, if people are responding to those things. I had a question that someone asked me, and they really wanted to know about goitrogens. And is that something to worry about with thyroid health?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, and that's probably the number one question that I get asked time after an article. And I actually saw this video that Chris Kressler did at Paleo FX. I must have been on another panel when he was speaking that, and I really enjoyed it. And he was really talking about how it has to do with iodine, and that when – let me just back up and say, I personally – don't pay any attention to it, but I don't have a thyroid. So I eat kale and I eat raw kale like out the wazoo. I mean, every morning in a smoothie, and I'm broccoli, and I mean, I am eating them. So the goitrogens are the cruciferous vegetables. So the broccolis, the kales, the cabbage, and the cauliflower. So my understanding is that when you cook these foods, it reduces the goitrogenic effect of them. When you ferment them, it can increase the effect. The effect is believed to be through iodine and creating an iodine deficiency. And we did talk about leaky gut and gluten being as one of the factors in creating thyroid problems. The other theory out there is that it's actually low iodine, that we used to have iodine in everything, salt, and then we started fluorinating chlorinating and brominating everything. So we have chlorine in all our water and our swimming pools. We have fluoride in, you know, in our toothpaste and our water. And then bromine is in a lot of baked goods. It's used like in baking soda and flours. They brominate the flour. So it's in wheat as well, most all, and cereals and all that kind of stuff. And so these are called halides, and they displace iodine. The most concentration of iodine in our body is in our thyroid. And these halides, fluoride, chlorine, and bromide, displace iodine in the thyroid. And so the theory is that we are all basically walking around iodine deficient. Mm. And that is one of the theories out there, along with, you know, a whole host of, you know, what I say is gluten, leaky gut, then there's the iodine theory, and then there's the heavy metal mercury theory about the mercury disrupting the thyroid gland. Well, and then there are also theories which, you know, when we're coming to autoimmune, which is viruses like the herpes virus, Epstein-Barr virus, getting in and creating inflammation and altering the immune system as well. So those are probably the four. That's more with autoimmune, with the viruses. But the others, the mercury could be just general hypothyroidism or autoimmune. Of course, iodine, both of them as well, and then gluten, both of them as well. And then there's what I alluded to, and this is in my article as well, about, you know, what you need for your thyroid to actually function properly. I mean, to make that conversion from T4 to T3, we need selenium, at least probably 200 micrograms a day. So we need iron. A lot of people that are coming in to me, I check a ferritin on them, which is looking at their iron storage. And people have a ferritin of 10. It's a woman who doesn't eat much meat. She's a menstruating female. And so she's really not getting her iron. I mean, we want that up over 50, if not closer to 100. So you really need that for the thyroid, and then B vitamins, and then iodine. So I check all of those. Checking an iodine level of on someone is very difficult. There are two ways that I know of that can be done. One is called a skin test, where you just basically go get like some mercurochrome that has iodine in it, or I guess there are iodine solutions that you can get even at like a health food store, and you kind of put a swatch on your arm and you see how quickly that disappears. The more quickly that disappears, the idea is that you're uptaking more iodine and your body needs it. Now, the argument against that is that everyone absorbs things through their skins at different rates. And so, you know, how do you really set a standard for that? So I personally don't use that. There's another test it's sort of like how I do a heavy metal test. It's an iodine challenge test, and you basically take a big dose of iodine. And when I say big, I mean it's like 25 milligrams. And when we're talking about iodine, most of the time we're talking about it in micrograms. So like in our multivitamin, it has 150 micrograms. I put people on some extra iodine frequently when they have thyroid issues, iodine and tyrosine, to help make that conversion from T4 to T3. And that has about 300 micrograms in it. So we're talking, you know, thousandfold amounts of iodine. And basically you take a large dose of iodine. You then collect your urine over the next 24 hours, and you basically see how much ends up in your urine. And again, the theory is the less that ends up in your urine, the more your body uptook because it needed it. So again, it's just the argument against that is that kidneys function differently. There are just so many different factors. What was in your stomach? How did you absorb it? So I have done that test on people who really wanted to know, but I don't do that test very frequently at all. So I certainly believe whether it actually is causing problems with the thyroid or not. I mean, I do believe about, you know, these chlorines, the fluorides, they are not good for us. And so I do give people some amount of iodine. I don't really talk to my patients about the goitrogenic effects, which was your initial question, because, you know, in every scenario, you really got to look at the, you know, positive and negative. And so to not eat broccoli, to not eat cauliflower, to not eat kale, you know, what's the benefit, you know, what's the risk of that versus the benefit of what you're going to get from it? Is it something to be aware of? For sure. Particularly if you're somebody not on thyroid medicine and you notice or get the diagnosis that your thyroid is what we'd call sluggish, like not completely optimal, maybe you'd want to go off those things, see if it made a difference. Of course, iodine, you know, I would counsel somebody about changing all this stuff. For somebody like me, you know, I'm fully dependent on thyroid medicine. So, you know, I would just take more medicine if I needed it. But I don't have a thyroid, so I don't, you know, I don't think it's a, it obviously can't be affecting me. With my other patients on thyroid medicine, you know, it comes up, but I don't really advise people to not be eating these foods. I just, I would maybe add a little extra iodine in and hopefully balance out the situation.
Okay. So then you would, so I'm interested in that link there between the iodine and the selenium. So often when people come in with thyroid issues, you do supplement with selenium and iodine as well, as B vitamins?
You know, in my personal opinion, we live in a toxic world. We live in a soil depleted world. We, you know, our vegetables are not what they used to be. I mean, it's just, we're stressed. Our guts aren't working well. I put everybody on what I consider to be a very high quality multivitamin. So the multivitamin that we have in my office is actually 6 pills. And so it really has high dosages of a lot of things. It has all the B vitamins and they're pre-methylated. So they're in the, you know, most usable form. They're not synthetic. It has 200 micrograms of selenium in it. It has iodine in it. You know, we do have ones that have iron. So if you're a female, we may go on that one. I usually can check your ferritin levels. I do have some sophisticated testing that I can check selenium levels and things like that. But, you know, if you're not up for doing that whole test, I just assume, you know, it's not going to hurt you to have a little extra selenium if you don't need it. I put everybody on a really high quality multivitamin. And my belief, that everyone needs a multivitamin, a fish oil, probiotics, and likely some vitamin D, but I do check your levels. So those are kind of my bare bone basics. And I think, you know, everybody out there listening to this podcast could benefit from being on those things, from those, you know, supplementations. Yes, in an ideal world, I would like it that each one of us could get everything that we need from food. It is not my goal to put people on a bunch of supplements. I do put people on supplements in the beginning to overcome their imbalances. And once we've gotten the body back in balance and fixed the gut, we can come off of those. But at the end of the day, I do think that everybody could benefit from a multivitamin, fish oils, probiotics, and likely some vitamin D just because of, you know, unfortunately, the world that we live in. Our food is not what it was, and there are more toxins, and we're more stressed. And so,
is there any link between, I mean, I know all of this is so intertwined with each other, but is there any link between hormone imbalances and adrenal fatigue in relation to the thyroid?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's all they are all your hormones. It's your thyroid hormone, they're your adrenal hormones, your female or male sex hormones. This entire system, the endocrine system, works in a very intricate web. So again, to just think that that you are going to touch one system and it's not going to affect the others, or if you have an imbalance in one system, that it's not going to cause an imbalance in all of them. I didn't bring up in my list, perhaps I should have had it written down, you know, full list of, you know, other with the hypo and hyper. I mean, with females, you know, certainly imbalances in their cycles, either not having a cycle when you're hyper, or having irregular cycles or painful, heavy cycles when you're hypo. And then, you know, certainly sex drive and energy can be related there as well with the thyroid. So a lot of us believe that if you do need to, or the theory or what they say when I was going through my training about, you know, thyroid, never address the thyroid until you've addressed the adrenals, that a lot of times the cause is actually in the adrenals. And I of course do that. Again, that's another one of those things that the day you're walking in my office, we're talking about those stressors. We are, you know, removing the foods that could be stressing the adrenal system. We are fixing the leaky gut, you know, that could be harming the adrenal system. We're talking about the job, the marriage, the, you know, everything involved with the adrenal system. And frequently, I'll put people on herbal adaptogenic supplement right off the bat with the adrenal glands. People will come in and be like, I think I have adrenal fatigue. I want to do a test. Like, well, we can do a test. Or, you know, the very end of the spectrum of adrenal fatigue is having to go on steroids. And I really don't do that for people. I have on an extremely rare occasion, but everything else, it's going to be to find out why the adrenals are fatigued in the first place, and let's get to the root cause. Do you have heavy metals? Do you have a gluten issue? Are you working 150 hours a week? Are you drinking 6 cups of coffee? You know, what is it? And let's address it from that standpoint, and let's give you some adaptogenic herbs. So while we're finding the cause and addressing the cause, let's support your adrenal glands. So frequently, I do that with many people starting out. And then when people opt to not do that or whatever, they didn't get the supplement, and then we get them on the thyroid medicine and I put them on a very, very low dose, and they're like, oh my God, I was flipping out. I couldn't handle it. And you're thinking, well, wait, your labs are still low. This is really weird. Your labs are still not even normal range, but you're telling me you feel, you know, very hyper on this stuff. And it's like, oh, the adrenal glands. We haven't really addressed the adrenal glands. So that's a common mistake of, you know, kind of people starting out or not really understanding how all those hormones work together. And then, of course, when you address the thyroid and the adrenal glands, a lot of times these irregular periods or even infertility, you know, people are getting pregnant. They're having regular periods. Their PMS has gone away. So absolutely. And then, of course, it works. It's sort of it's a big circle. And so, you know, we're talking about the thyroid, but you could certainly say, how are these, you know, someone's coming in with a female hormone issue, and how is that then affecting the thyroid, or how is that affecting the adrenal gland? So they all affect one another.
Okay. Amy, do you have any experience with low-dose naltrexone?
I don't. I was at a conference recently, and we were beginning to discuss it. I personally have not used it. I have had patients talk to me about it. I just don't have enough experience in it, but I know that it has been extremely helpful for people with some autoimmune conditions and certainly things like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. I do know a gastroenterologist that uses it for those reasons, so I typically refer people to him because I just, you know, it's not an area that I've gotten into. I mean, it's both an agonist and an antagonist, which means that it both activates those pain receptors as well as blocks them. I mean, I have experience of it in the ER. You know, it's what we would give people to get them to come out of when they came in with an overdose, because it blocks those receptors. But it, you know, the fact that it's also used for people coming off of heroin and stuff like that. So there is a potential, you know, abuse effect to it. So I haven't felt comfortable getting into that realm personally.
Gotcha. I have explored it a little bit, and I found some really interesting results, especially around skin conditions and things like that. So it's definitely an interesting area. Maybe we'll chat about that in the future at some point.
Yeah, that would be an interesting one for sure.
Well, great. So we're getting to the end here, and I kind of wanted to just zoom out a bit again, and I just want to ask you kind of this question, very, very simple. How do people know? So they come in and they have an issue like this, a thyroid issue. How do they know when it's cleared, or is it cleared, or is it a constant kind of going back and forth of testing, seeing where your thyroid levels are at? What's your experience with, I know you said in one of the previous podcasts, you've kind of healed people from Hashimoto's.
Yeah, so I think it depends on what the issue is. I mean, the point of functional medicine is to find the root cause. So if someone, I certainly have people who've been borderline or low and they never go on medication, and we get them off the gluten, we get them on some selenium, give them some iodine, and their thyroid levels turn completely normal. The people with autoimmune conditions, I get them to where I have been able to get people. I mean, it's very fascinating. You just get them off the gluten and boom, boom, boom. I track their antibodies coming down. Someone like myself who has taken, you know, such a radical, dramatic step of having a thyroid ablated, I mean, I will always be on thyroid hormone. So it really depends on what that root cause is and if we're able to get to it or not. Are you able to get off medicine? Do you not need to go on medicine? Are we checking your levels? Are we just really tracking your antibodies? So For most people that get on medication, and I know we're running out of time, but I did want to hit on that ever so quickly because that's also a huge question that people have, and I will do that real quickly. But you know, usually once people are on a stable dose and their antibodies have come down, I'm really just checking that once a year for them, or you know, I'm always happy to check it if they've noticed a change, they're feeling more fatigued or they're feeling, you know, wired or something like that. But usually it's a matter of, you know, getting them on the right dose, checking those antibodies, seeing them come down. And certainly on occasions, getting people back off the medicine, if that's, you know, what their goal is to do. And just ever so quickly, did that answer the question?
Yeah, that's great. I actually was wondering there too, is there, I mean, I guess people, a lot of people don't want to be on medication, but is there any problems with being on medication? You're on medication. Is there any issues with that?
Well, it depends on what you call an issue. You know, okay. Some people would say that, you know, that thyroid hormone is synthetic and that they're, you know, different, you know, lake dye number 5 in it, and that's an issue. Other people, you know, are taking quote unquote natural thyroid coming from a pig and, you know, they have an issue because they don't know where the pig gland came from. So it depends on what you call an issue. Is there an issue with the body? Our body is smart. So the theory for many people, what they would call an issue is that if you give someone, you know, external sources of thyroid hormone, their thyroid itself is going to stop production. That you could give somebody and that they could overproduce. I've never, short of somebody who actually had an autoimmune disease that was probably going to flip to being hyperthyroid anyway, I've rarely seen anybody take medicine and their thyroid overproduce or come in a hyper state. Our body is smart. If it's getting what it needs, those feedback mechanisms are in there. The theory that your body stops producing the thyroid, that's certainly plausible that that's a theory that your body's going to, you know, it's going to regulate itself. But again, I always put somebody with hormones of any sort on the lowest amount needed to be in optimal range. So just very cognizant of that. So quickly, since we're running out of time, just the difference in types of medicines. So as we mentioned about the thyroid to begin with, there's T4 that the thyroid primarily makes, and it makes a little bit of T3, but it converts much of the T or a little bit of the T4 into T3, and then we need to convert that to free T3 or reverse T3. So when you take Synthroid or Levoxyl, which are the synthetic forms of thyroid hormone, they are T4 only. And I do use those on occasion for people who really are not having a problem converting T4 to T3 or into free T3. If you're not having a problem with that conversion, you know, some people just do better on the T4. There are ones that do not have, you know, any dye color in them and things like that. So we try to opt for that. If the other option is, if you are having a problem with converting from T4 to T3 or into that free T3, you can take, again, the synthetic T4, Synthroid or Levoxyl, and then add in some compounded T3. You could do Cytomel, which is a prescription. It is very short-acting. Free T3, the T4 hormone is a very long-acting hormone. It's like 9 days or something is the half-life, and that is one of our longest-acting hormones, if not the longest in our body. So when you start taking T4, that's why your doctor doesn't check your levels for another month or two or three down the line, because it really takes that long for the body to, you know, integrate that. T3, on the other hand, is extremely fast-acting. And so Cytomel is a prescription form of T3. I really don't use that much because it can be so quick acting. It's quick on, quick off, that people get a burst of energy, like drinking a cup of coffee, and then it's gone. So unless someone has to do that for insurance reasons or financial reasons, I really don't use that one. I use a compounded T3, which is the same medicine, but the compounding pharmacy is able to put a binding agent in it to have it be a sustained release. So it's released over 12 hours. So you get that, you know, burst of energy, but it lasts a lot longer. So that is one sort of combination that can be used. The other is the quote unquote more natural forms of thyroid hormone out there, which are the Nathroid and the Armour. And those are coming from pig sources. And those are coming really, it is basically desiccated thyroid gland of a pig. And the, you know, upside of that is that there may even be thyroid hormones, T1, 2, some people allude to, that we don't even really know about. And that those are, of course, found in that quote-unquote medication, because it's coming from the actual gland of another, you know, animal. The downside of that is that it's T, well, the other upside of that is that it's T4 and T3. So you don't either have to take, just the T4, and if you're not converting to T3, then you have that and you don't have to take two pills. So that's great. The downside of that is that it's in a preformed concentration of T4 to T3. So if that's not the concentration that your body needs, then you might be either, have too much T4 or too much T3, and then you can't really alter one or the other. So, I just really listen to the patient, look at the labs, figure out what's going on, ask them, do they have a choice? And so in order to make my decision, I don't feel, strongly, one way or the other. I've been on them all. I currently am taking a very small dose of Synthroid, and I also take Armour because I was not having enough T4 but having too much T3. But that, that's what I do, is listen to the patient. Of course, there are also supplements, quote unquote, that, like, Standard Process does a lot of supplements that use glands in them. I'm not an advocate of those personally because, I get something that is, from a pharmacy that, is being tested, that this is what it says it is. It's a clean product. A lot of people on those products that I've found that come into me are on them from people who aren't able to prescribe or cannot order lab tests. And, those are basically like Armour or Nature-Throid, but without a prescription. So if you're on one of those, I mean, you really need to be with somebody who can monitor your levels, because those are essentially, prescription medications, but sold in a supplement bottle. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but you just need to make sure whoever's giving it to you is actually checking your thyroid levels, because I have had people, and same with the adrenal glands. They make a lot of adrenal, desiccated adrenal gland supplements, and I'm not picking on that particular company. There are just, that's the one I know of most widely that make these glandular products. And just, if you're on any of these things, you need to make sure whoever you're with is able to test your labs, because I have definitely had people coming in from other practitioners that, oh, it's just a supplement. The patient didn't even know it was a glandular supplement, and things have been really, really, really out of whack. So that's that on the, different forms of medications.
Cool. Well, Amy, what I'm present to now is, after you kind of gave us this sort of everything you need to know about thyroid, is that just like all of these kinds of conditions, it's a complex one, and the benefit of going to see someone who can take all this into account is really important. I was just sort of listing here all the different places that when we're addressing thyroid, what they are. And you kind of mentioned them, but just to give a little recap, we started with leaky gut, then we moved into the sort of fluoride, chlorine, bromide, then to mercury, then to potentially herpes virus or Epstein-Barr, then vitamin and mineral deficiencies, especially selenium, iodine, B vitamins, and iron, adrenal issues. So there's so much going on there, and I can see why working with someone is a really important thing. It seems like from all these things, though, one thing that someone who hasn't gone to a doctor yet but might have some of these symptoms could just do right away is getting is work dealing with those leaky gut issues by getting right away onto some kind of good diet, especially the one, or at least one of the ones that you mentioned in the Myers Way.
Absolutely. So, and as you guys with Clean just came out, is the, is your Clean Gut book. So people can pick up a copy of that. I've certainly written articles about leaky gut on my blog. Just posted one yesterday of 8 supplements to help heal a leaky gut. They can get on the Myers Way. So there are a lot of, choices out there for people to help, with themselves, with these conditions. And two final thoughts. The biggest parting one that I can say is just the connection between thyroid and gluten. If you know me, I think gluten's the root of all evil. So that's the number one
Ha
step. The number one step, I'd say, getting on a good quality multivitamin, trying to, heal your leaky gut through the resources we just mentioned, the, Clean Gut, the Myers Way, some of the blog posts that I've written, and than finding a functional medicine practitioner. You can certainly print off my blog that we'll post a link to on this podcast, and you know, print that out, take it with you to your doctor. Unfortunately, even when people come in, you know, with knowledge and information, doctors are either fearful or they're regulated by the insurance industries, and you know, they may simply refuse to do that, or once they get it, they may not really understand it. So, you know, always trying to find a functional medicine practitioner to help out is going to be key.
All right. Well, thanks, Amy. Thanks for everything we need to know about thyroid. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, John.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers MD.